Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 78. One voice from two worlds. Native people's stories. Part 1. Selections from a book edited by Mary Jo Moore called Genocide of the Mind, New Native American Writing. Published by Thunder's Mouth Press Nation Books. And dedication says, for our elders, past, present, and future. Interesting things about the book is hearing from Native peoples in their own voices and realizing the extent to which they are intermingled with the mainstream American culture. Even in the New York area, there are, I think, about 80,000 Native peoples, but we tend to not realize that, I think. So hopefully hearing some of this book will open you to that possibility of knowing and connecting with someone from tribal or nation land. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Back in the saddle here at the few weeks into the year of the horse, the Chinese astrology, and this book actually has some drawings of horses on the cover. I don't know if this is part one because I'm about halfway through this book, but I don't know. I've got a bunch of page notes and quotes to read, so I don't know how long that's going to take. So part one, without knowing how many parts will follow. Now, this book came out in 2003. I think I got it about then, and I remember reading a section or two, and for some reason just could not or did not get into it, whether the timing or it was not, I wasn't ready to read it or whatever. I know the title, for some reason, put me off a little bit, but now picked it up again recently and can barely put it down. It's real stories from the real people. It's not the stories about the culture, about the history of Native peoples, as fascinating as that is, but I think it's a key area that we tend to overlook is people today living in the world, in the cultures, in the two worlds, many of them on reservations, and then they go back and forth. Sometimes they move away from their nations or reservations and visit occasionally, so it really conveys the personal issues and struggles that many of us may feel with the dominant culture, but it's especially sharp for the native peoples. I'll read the back cover blurb because that pretty much sums it up better than I could. After 5 centuries of Eurocentrism, many people have little idea that Native American tribes still exist or which traditions belong to what tribes. America's indigenous peoples have been effectively stereotyped through different forms of media as spiritual gurus, pagan savages, Indian princesses, or pitiful burdens of society. Over the past decade, however, there has been a rising movement to accurately describe Native cultures and histories. In particular, writers have begun to explore the experience of urban Indians, individuals who live in two worlds, struggling to preserve traditional Native values within the context of an ever-changing modern society. Genocide of the Mind is a moving and inspiring collection of essays that records the determination of people from over 25 different nations to bring the Native American experience into the 21st century. And there are some, quote, big names, well-known names. I haven't read much of them, but Simon Ortiz, Leslie Marmon Silko, and those are the two that I recognize, and the editor, Mary Jo Moore. And the foreword is by Vine Deloria Jr., who is perhaps the most cited and recognized as making a huge difference in the literary map and cultural awareness and transformation of the Native peoples in this era. And a notable thing also about this book is that, the oft-quoted All My Relations, the neatest, tidiest way of summing up the Native perspective is that in this book a lot of the writers, you know, pay their homage and give thanks to their relatives like aunts and uncles, grandparents, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's something that I think every culture has, but it especially touched me while reading this book because it's sort of the unsung, unnamed heroes that are carrying on the culture and the tradition, whereas in a lot of American and Western culture, it's sort of like, whether it's movie stars, sports heroes, those become our sort of mythological heroes, whereas in the Native culture, I think these are more some of the heroes. And this is a quote from Catherine Lucci Cooper. Our oral tradition, which is both ceremonially sacred and ritualized through the use of language, is also living thought. The elder women of my family nourished themselves through the telling and retelling of stories. Their stories brought them merciful shelter through the spoken transformation of time and place. The question of how to adapt to the present dominant culture while maintaining tribal values is a 500-year-old conflict among First Nations peoples. When my mother said that she had put all of her strawberries into my basket, she was, in effect, referring to this conflict. And she says that these are the fruitful offerings of their stories. And this quote from Mary Jo Moore's section, she talks about the influence of her granddaddy, and she writes, "Some people call granddaddy crazy. He drank heavily and was known to be quite a carouser in his time, but his craziness has manifested itself in my spirit as the madness of creativity, and for this I am grateful. The words he spoke to the stars are the words that sparkle in my writings, and the blood he passed on to me is the blood of survival." And she ends her little section with, "My deepest belief is in spiritual interconnectedness, that everything has a voice and speaks to those who will listen. I continue to listen to the spirit of place, to the winds as they blow over blue-ridged mountains, to the voices of birds and animals, to the sound of unburned fires lying in ancient trees. And I continue to write, trying, as Granddaddy suggested, leading others to the truth concerning American Indians. I know he is pleased. My dreams tell me so." Another, the book is in various sections. First section is Keeping the Home Fires Burning in Urban Circles. Section 2 is Young American Indians, the Need to Reclaim Identity. 3, Native Languages, Where Will They Go From Here? And that's as far as this reader has got. And this is this one is from Gabriel Horn. He writes, "Americans need to have these images and names in order to deny their history." He's talking about mascots, stereotyping. "Americans need to have these images and names in order to deny their history, for a history wrought with genocide and a democracy riddled with evil must be denied, or the foundation of the United States would crumble." I think that really touches on one of the biggest issues, that for a lot of people, if you start to look at the reality, you realize that the whole structure of the dominant society is built on this facade, on this not only just ignoring the natives, but, you know, the literal squelching down and genocidal treatment that in some forms continues today, as even in South Dakota with the taking of children and putting them in other homes, taking them away from their families. So I think that's a key thing to remember as to why much of this information has been squelched and put out of the mainstream. So, you know, books like these, radio shows, however, movies, films, the burgeoning of technology today is a big help to help people see more and more of what the real culture is about. And another beautiful bit from Gabriel here. He's talking with an uncle. Gabriel, he asked, gesturing with his free hand, which half of you is Indian? Which half isn't? Is it your upper half or your lower half? Your back half or your front? Well, he said, seeming to grow somewhat impatient, which one is it? This is Gabriel's talking about being, you know, half Indian and having to face that. For a brief moment, I actually pondered the answer and considered the possibilities. Then suddenly I felt silly, and I am certain my expression reflected this, because those penetrating sky-blue eyes of his smiled. I shrugged, and I told him that I could not answer his question. Then his lips tightened into seriousness, and he asked me to shut my eyes. I did, as he wished, and stood there in the darkness. What does your heart tell you, Gabriel? What does your heart tell you, Indian or white? My automatic reply sprang without haste and burst into the spoken word. Indian, I said, opening my eyes. He sat back in his chair. Gabriel, he said, then that is what you are. Our people do not come in percent of blood. Our people do not come in parts. You can't be part this, part that. You either are Indian or you are not Indian at all. And so I was forever set on the path of heart. And this by Dave Stevenson in the Urban Youth section. Interesting statistic. Due to forced and voluntary assimilation and quests for conveniences, refuge, or anonymity, 60% of America's native people now reside in urban areas. We drift, we run, we abandon our communities with little forethought or fanfare. We plan, we coordinate, we accept jobs and attend colleges. Sometimes we hitch rides and stumble upon urban landscapes. They are teeming emerald cities that at once hold bright promises of affluence and dark promises of disconnection. Some of us were carried to cities by our parents when we were infants. Many of us were born in cities. Even then, our spirits perceived a profound sense of displacement. The second great displacement of Native America commenced in the 1950s at the start of the termination era. Natives were forcibly moved to urban areas or given incentives to relocate voluntarily by transplanting families and germinating tribes' special relationships with the federal government. The dominant culture hoped to definitively eradicate Native peoples. The eagerly anticipated denouement was that, deprived of recognition and thrust into multi-ethnic urban neighborhoods, we would breed out our blood and lose our identities. Our memories would falter, we would be cast adrift. Anglo-America would be freed from an uncomfortable reality and could pursue its invented identity and illegal occupation of America with renewed ardor and absolution. I was born into urban America, a product of assimilation. And he goes on, we are told stories from back home, stories that are placid pools in a raging river, stories that are ancient, real, and profound. I was told timeless bear stories that contain invaluable lessons and fundamental truths. Our stories are juxtaposed with the faux yarns that blare from omnipresent media, from which so many Americans receive artificial knowledge and messages. Mainstream media threaten to supersede and usurp our memories. They suck us ever deeper into sorrowful depths. The termination forced assimilation era was accompanied by the advent of television and a massive proliferation of new media sources. John Ford westerns and foolish Indian caricatures flickered from cathode ray screens and were smeared on the pages of glossy magazines. John Wayne and his fellow Indian fighters galloped to celluloid greatness by committing theatrical genocide, leaving impressionable viewers reveling in their dust. The media and the culture obviously hits deep. And he ends his chapter section with, I think he's talking about an ant here. woman who knows who she is, where she comes from, and where she belongs. She recognizes the offensive nature of the semiotics and messages we are so incessantly bombarded with, but isn't embittered. She returns to the city rejuvenated. This is after her going back to the reservation or tribal lands. She returns to the city rejuvenated and possessed of endless inspiration. Again, she transforms stark white canvases into scenes of unsurpassed beauty and emotion. The woman's passions pour out of her soul and become visual poetry, referring to her being a painter. If she feels the tug of the undercurrent and begins to falter, she always returns home to the warmth of her land and family. The woman always remembers. Native American thought and cultures are ineffable. Contemporary Native wisdom speakers like Vine Deloria Jr., Paula Gunn Allen, and Orrin Lyons have eloquently explained many of our truths and understanding. Innumerable anthropological tomes have been written on our cultures and histories, but there is always a facet of our life, ways that remain indefinable. It can perhaps best be described as a smooth flowing, a continuity of the land and its animals and ourselves, an uninterrupted progression. We are part of the totality, and we are confident the totality will always remain. The land completes us, it makes us whole. Always we flow with it. And the last paragraph of his bit. I scaled an Alaskan mountain that rises straight from the fertile tide water. I stood on a precipice on the cusp of an impenetrable ice field above the tree line. I reclaimed memories and an identity that had always whispered softly from the spruce boughs and fertile earth. I flowed slowly to the fork where the rivers meet. The maelstrom roiled in my distant wake. I heard my grandmother whisper bear stories from a distant stand of cedar and hemlock. Perhaps her grandmother whispered around her, always remember who you are. Beautifully written, and certainly with the name of this show being Between the Lines, appreciate, you know, what he says about the connection with the land, and no matter how many books are written, there is still the very much a flavor of the Tao there, the flow and the totality that is. Now, getting into the language section, the importance of language. This is from Simon Ortiz, Acoma Pueblo, well-known writer. For example, when my father has said a word in speech or in song, and I ask him, what does that word break down to? I mean, breaking it down to the syllables of sound or phrases of sound. What do each of the parts mean? And he tells me, it doesn't break down into anything. For him, the word does not break down into any of the separate elements that I expect. The word he has said is complete. The word is there, complete in its entity of meanings and usage. But I, with many years of formal American education and some linguistic training, having learned and experienced English as a language, having learned to recognize the parts of a sentence, speech, the etymology of words, that words are separable into letters and sounds and syllables of vowels and consonants, I have learned to be aware that a word does break down into basic parts or elements. Like my Navajo friend who is taking the Navajo language course, I have on occasion come to expect, even demand, that I hear and perceive the separated elements of Indian spoken words. But as my father has said, a word does not break down into separate elements. A word is complete. In the same way, a song really does not break down into separate elements. In the minds and views of the people singing at my home or in a Navajo religious ceremony, for whatever purpose that song is meant and used, whether it be for prayer, a dancing event, or as part of a story, the song does not break down. It is part of the complete voice of a person. Language, when it is regarded not only as expression, but is realized as experience as well, works in and of that manner. Language is perception of experience as well as expression. That perhaps sums up how it feels to me as a poet. The language is perception of experience as well as perception, because when I'm in that zone of, you know, seeing the world or seeing nature or having feelings and trying to describe them, it is the perception of the experience and the expression of the language that come together. So it kind of confirms my sense that, you know, poetry in a way is like a step closer to native way of thinking or native language, and that it helps to connect dots in a whole way that in some way our English language, you know, the common spoken tongue doesn't, but that whether it's poems or speaking in a metaphorical poetic way, it gets closer, I think, to my understanding of what, you know, this wondrousness that I have heard about from, say, Lakota language, where a huge percent of it can't be even translated into English, or Mohawk, where, you know, the way they describe the color of a dress is not that it's green, but it's the color of the grass in spring. And so that sense of poetic and experience and language seem to me, from the little that I know, it's just so much inherent in the native languages. And a few more bits here. This is again Ortiz describing his father and part of the hunting process. He is one of the elders of the antelope people who are in charge of all the spiritual practice and philosophy of our people. I don't know how to pronounce it. Akume. Oh, that would be the Akoma. Looks like the native spelling of the Akoma Pueblo. AACQUMEH. He and his uncles are responsible for things continuing in the manner that they have since time began for us, and in this sense he is indeed a 1,000-year-old man. In the box are the necessary items that go with prayer, the feathers, pollen, precious bits of stone and shell, cotton string, earth paints, cornmeal, tobacco, and other things. The feathers of various birds are wrapped in several years old newspaper to keep the feathers smooth. It is his duty to ensure that the prayer songs of the many and various religious ceremonies survive and continue. My father sings, and I listen. Song at the very beginning was experience. There was no division between experience and expression. Even now, I don't think there is much of a division except arbitrary. Take a child, for example. When he makes a song at his play, especially when he is alone, in his song he tells about the experience of the sensations he is feeling at the moment with his body and mind, and the song comes about as words and sounds, expression. But essentially in those moments the song that he is singing is what he is experiencing. The child's song is both perception of that experience and his expression of it. And he continues, no division between expression and perception. Song is the experience of that opening or road, if you prefer, and there is no separation of parts, no division between expression and perception. I think that is what has oftentimes happened with our use of English. We think of English as a very definitive language, useful in defining things, which means setting limits. But that's not what language is supposed to be. Language is not definition. Language is all expansive. We, thinking ourselves capable of the task, assign rules and roles to language unnecessarily. Therefore, we limit our words, our language, and we limit our perception, our understanding, and our knowledge. Children don't limit their words until they learn how, until they're told that it's better if they use definitive words. This is what happens to most everyone in formal educational situations. Education defines you. It makes you see with and within very definitive limits. Unless you teach and learn language in such a way as to permit it to remain or for it to become all expansive and truly visionary, your expressiveness and perceptions will be limited and even divided. And that reminds of another one. Teokusin Ghost Horse had put up a note on his Twitter or Facebook page about how some native indigenous languages don't even have the word or the concept for want. I mean, they have to stop and think about that. You know, mainstream culture, Western culture, you know, I want this, or, you know, the advertising, you'll want that, and, you know, I want some food, I want sex, I want a new this, I want a new that. It's just the amount of wants, and then stop and look at this culture that does not have want. I mean, just makes me stop and say, okay, I'm just going to spend 5 minutes here, and what does it feel like not to want? And that puts me in a different place, a different direction. It changes, you know, what I might do next. So that's a deep thing. And Simon Ortiz, and this last bit of section here from Simon Ortiz. One time my father was singing a song, and this is what the instance in which this perception by expression up became very apparent to me. He was singing this song and I didn't catch the words offhand. I asked him and he explained, this song, I really like it for this old man. And he said, this old man used to like to sing and he danced like this. Motioning like the old man's hands, arms, shoulders, he repeated, this song, I really like it for this old man. This is what the song was about, I realized. It was both his explanation and the meaning of the song. It was about this old man who danced that way with whom my father shared a good feeling. My father had liked the old man who was probably a mentor of some sort, and in my father's mind, during the process of making the song and when he sang it subsequent times afterward, he was reaffirming the affection he had for the old guy the way, quote, he danced like this. My father was expressing to me the experience of that affection, the perceptions of the feelings he had. Indeed, the song was the road from outside himself to inside, which is perception, and from inside himself to outside, which is expression. That's the process and the product of the song, the experience and the vision that a song gives you. The words, the language of my experience come from how I understand, how I relate to the world around me, and how I know language as perception. That language allows me vision to see with and by which to know myself. And a little addendum here. The status of the Acoma language is that it is a strong, continuing language, but like all other native languages, it is affected by the constant, overpowering, sometimes overwhelming dominance of the English language. People my age and older are strong speakers, a good number of them fluent in the language. Sadly, the following generations, including our children, are not so fluent and in cases do not speak native languages at all. There is, however, an insistence by the tribal community on the use of the language, including the teaching of it in tribal language programs. Good place to stop and just letting the whole thing about affection, perception, expression, language, non-language, words cannot be broken down, all of that, just kind of, just being with that is, feels like enough. Want to touch on some of the bios of the people here, because that's important to recognize who these people are. Let's see, Catherine Lucci Cooper is a Cherokee Sicilian author and bead weaving artist, a member of the Native American Journalist Association and Wordcraft Circle of Native Writers. She was selected as one of 10 new North Carolina writers in 2001 when her short story Luther's Storm was featured in the Raleigh News and Observer Sunday Journal. Mary Jo Moore, Cherokee Irish Dutch, is a poet, author, essayist, artist, publisher. Her books include Spirit Voices of Bones, Red Woman with Backward Eyes, and other stories. She's the owner of Renegade Planets Publishing. She is the recipient of numerous literary and publishing awards. She spells it with a small r and then the rest of the letters capital, small p, the rest of the letters capital, and small p, Renegade Planets Publishing. And she is the editor of this book. And she has a little introduction to each section. And Gabrielle Horn, also named White Deer of Autumn, is a nationally recognized lecturer on writing and Native American philosophy and its intricate connection to the rights of indigenous people, animals, and the welfare of the natural environment. He has a BA in Language Arts and an MA in Writing and Native American Studies. His written works include Ceremony in the Circle of Life, The Great Change, and the Native People, Native Ways series. His two critically acclaimed books, Native Heart, An American Indian Odyssey, and Contemplations of a Primal Mind, are now used across the country in secondary school and university curricula. He lives with his wife in St. Petersburg, Florida. One neat thing about reading the bios is you realize the whole level of literary magazines and journals and such like that there is a network that Native people have that, you know, again, would be unbeknown to us settler types if we didn't know. And Simon Ortiz, Tiz, O-R-T-I-Z. Poet, fiction writer, essayist, storyteller, is a native of Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico. His published works include Men on the Moon, Woven Stone, The People Shall Continue, Speaking for the Generations, and Out There Somewhere. He has been involved with Native educational endeavors from elementary school to college levels on a number of Indian reservations and urban Native communities. He is the father of one son and two daughters and also a grandfather. He resides in Toronto, Canada, where he teaches creative writing, contemporary Native North American literature, and Aboriginal studies at the University of Toronto. And one more bio to add, Dave Stevenson, as I try to pronounce it, T-L-I-N-G-I-T, Tlingit Eagle,
Tlingit and Haida, H-A-I-D-A tribes from southeast Alaska. His Tlingit name is, I won't even try to pronounce it. No, that was not his name and not a joke. But it's G-U-N-E with an accent, I, a space, an underscore, an I, and a K. He has a bachelor's degree in communications from Fort Lewis College in Colorado, where he graduated magna cum laude.
And just to finish up here, I want to read Mary Jo Moore's little paragraph introduction on the section, Native Languages, Where Will They Go From Here? Thousands of distinct American Indian languages have been silenced forever due to pandemics of smallpox and other diseases brought by European contact, acculturation, and total annihilation. Some linguists studying native languages estimate there are maybe 50 years left before all native languages are completely gone if they continue to dissipate at the rate they have over the past 100 years. In the 1800s, the government began an official policy of forcing Indians to attend boarding schools in order to wipe out all Indianness. This doctrine resulted in almost an entire generation not passing on language skills. Now, with the third generation emerging into adulthood, many Indian people are determined to revive their native languages. They are doing so in various ways, such as teaching language classes and encouraging their descendants to speak their native tongue. There are also those who are proudly proclaiming their Indian names with the intention of preventing the death of the spirit of their languages. For the remaining native languages to survive, concentration must now center on how to keep our languages alive instead of who to blame for the decimation. So again, the title of the book, Genocide of the Mind, New Native American Writing, published by Nation Books. You know, really, I encourage people to read something, you know, even if a section of a book, a short story, a poem, something by, you know, a Native Indigenous person, and just, you know, open your awareness, open your mind even a little bit into where they're at, where they're coming from, because that will help to do what they are trying to do, which is to keep their language and their culture strong. So, thanks for listening. Have a good one.
And we'll go out with a song from the CD Arctic Refuge, A Gathering of Tribes. This is T-O-H-A-T-A Tohata Lake by Jerry Alfred, who is Northern T-U-T-C-H-O-1-E. I'll say Tachoni. It looks like Touch One, but probably Tachoni. And that is... peoples mainly from the central Yukon in Canada, and Jerry Alfred is the song keeper.
Hey, hallelujah. Hey.